Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests tonight are Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch. Thursday, the legislature took up a bill that would impose fines on anyone who broadcast 911 calls on television, on radio, or the internet. Paul, there's several of these bills in different states, but why here and now in Alaska? What do you think?
I think there have been a couple of instances over the past few years where these kind of things have been broadcast, and I think some people really, really take a offense at it. This is a misdemeanor. The bill would be a misdemeanor law. With a $10,000 fine and no jail time. I think in a state where the public records law and such are just ignored by it's scary to me to find out, now we find out, during a testimony on this bill, that the troopers just routinely ignore it. You ask for public records, you ask for these things, which are public records, and they, it's too much trouble, we're not going to do it, that's it, and they don't do it. They fall in line with the rest of the government, I guess, at that point. But at this point, we should be trying to get more information, not less. I'm not sure why we're allowing troopers, low-level troopers at that, to make decisions on what public records are and what and how and when they'll be released. It's incredible to me that that's tolerated.
Thank you. Steve, how common is broadcasting 911 calls? And don't these calls from time to time quite clearly meet the title of news?
Right, as well as should. If you're going to use it in a news story, it better rise to that level. They're not used all that often. I'm trying to think of perhaps the most popular, or for lack of a better term, probably most recent case. It was Petra Davis, the young woman who was mauled by a brown bear. There was a 911 call from the scene there after she was on this in this bike race, and the brown bear attacked her. That was widely used, and probably the most recent case, I think. We only are able to broadcast these 911 calls through the cooperation of the troopers or the Anchorage Police Department. We would request these 911 tapes, and it's up to them, obviously, whether or not they're going to give it to us. In that case, they did. It may have helped. It told the story of what happened, shed light on what the situation was. Here was a young woman in the dark out in the middle of Bicentennial Park who is severely injured, and a Good Samaritan there is helping her as well. So it helps to tell that story, yes. But we don't record the scanner traffic where these 911 calls would come through. We hear them, of course. We have scanners, most news departments do. So you hear them, but we don't record them. We don't rebroadcast. The only time we do so is after getting permission from troopers, and they give us the tape.
I'm trying to remember, were there 911 calls in part, I mean, as public, as either evidence or news in the Godfrey shootings a few years ago?
Yeah, there
it
was.
It seems to me there were.
Yes, there
were calls to the police.
That's right. Those calls were released to the media as well by troopers. Ms. Godfrey making those calls after that horrible shooting. I can't think of anything between now and the Davis incident with the bear. I can't think of anything that probably we've used some.
One more question. Do you remember approximately how long it takes to get these tapes?
Sometimes it's within a few days. Sometimes it's pretty quick. Sometimes it's released also in the court. The court will use this. That's something I think we need to point out. I would really have to think about what the percentages would be here, but probably the majority of time that we get a 911 recording is in the court of law when the court decides to play these things to jurors to help, again, illustrate what the situation was when this happened.
And it's a lot easier to deal with the state court than the federal court.
Yeah. Yes.
We won't go into that sad story.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. Federal court
will. Jill, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I could say state versus federal. In state court, you have open access with your recording devices and your image,
yeah,
you know,
that's
your,
right.
your pictures typically, and can capture it as it's happening. But in federal court, typically you can get an audio recording of the day's proceedings, even though you can't be in there recording it yourself. So those, they're getting better at making those readily available. Sometimes the turnaround is same day, sometimes it's a day or two, but it's not completely blocked
out. If you plead or beg or bring John McKay and the lawyer to ask.
No, not really. They really are pretty forthcoming in federal court with those cassette with those tapes.
The tapes themselves,
yeah. They really are good.
Okay, let's stick with you, Steve. A story that doesn't seem to want to go away, Mayor Dan Sullivan and his father George's life insurance policy. Yeah. Now the Ethics Board has something to say.
Well, Ethics Board has stepped in and said that Mayor Dan Sullivan should have disclosed this potential conflict of interest. He was the executor of the will of his father's will, and back in 1982, I believe it was, the city agreed to issue this life insurance policy, which the Sullivan family paid the payments on. $193,000 came time to pay after former Mayor Sullivan, George Sullivan, passed away here about a year or so ago. And the paper went through the city. The city had to make the payment of this $193,000, and the assembly didn't realize that he was actually the executor of this will, that Mayor Dan Sullivan was the executor of the will. And that was referred to the Ethics Committee.
As a practical matter, what does this mean? The Ethics Board saying, go and sin no more? It would have been better if you'd done it this other way?
Yeah, it's the impression that I get is that, from now on. Dan Sullivan said, I didn't realize this. It was a life insurance policy. He says in his defense that he thought it was through a private insurance agency. He didn't realize it was actually through the city. And he just put in the paperwork and said, okay, well, this is due. And it wasn't until the assembly was to let the money that the questions really started. So he's basically saying, I know this now. It's doubtful this is ever going to happen again, at least with the Sullivan family, because this is the only kind of agreement that the city's ever made with a former chief executive of the city. But now there are some on the assembly who are just saying that, well, wait a minute, we really want to look into this further. And that's where the politics have now entered.
Let's get Paul in
issue.
Here. Paul, where does this end and how?
If they're smart, they'll let it end now. He received no proceeds from that payment. He received none of the money. His basic, his involvement was delivery of the death certificate to the assembly. Politically, it's pretty nice up until you get guys like Dan Coffey going and pointing out, hey, this is politics now. What are we going to do? You're beating a dead horse. And I think that if they're smart, they'll let it go now.
I'm confused. Dan Sullivan, presumably, he is the trustee, I guess, but presumably he's going to benefit in this from some way. I didn't understand what you were saying.
Well, he didn't get money from, he didn't get part of the proceeds.
Oh, I see.
It was a trust, but he didn't get any of the proceeds. So I'm not sure. He asked for the advisory opinion on what he should have done. I mean, this wasn't somebody said, well, we need to go after this guy and find out. He asked. He said, what should I have done? And they said, well, hey, you should, because at some point, municipal employees who work for you will have to handle this information or handle the bill. You should have let us everybody know. You should have declared it. And that's pretty much the answer. They did not rule that there was a conflict because nobody asked.
Thank you. Let's get Jill Burke in here for an extended period. Jill, of the Alaska Dispatch, you just had a court story about a lengthy lawsuit, a court case, a class action court case that has gone on for 26 years. Tell us about this unusual case.
This is a case that started when fishermen from outside the state of Alaska sued, arguing that the disproportionate fees that the state was charging for both licenses as well as surcharges to out-of-state fishermen above and beyond that which was being charged to in-state fishermen were unconstitutionally high. And the state, over the years, has challenged that. It's gone to several appeals, and they won. They won to some extent early on by a judge deciding that not all of those higher fees were unconstitutional because the state subsidizes through oil revenues, its management of the fisheries, and therefore it was okay to charge a bit more to out-of-state residents to compensate for some of that. However, they did find that when it came to permits, that it was inequitable and that refunds were appropriate. And so 26 years later, we are here with a judgment of $12.5 million to 4,000 or so eligible claimants in this class action lawsuit. The state has some consternation about this because a second prong of the case allowed for an interest rate to accrue on any of those back refunds. And that interest rate was 11% compounded quarterly. Over the course of 26 years, that adds up quite quickly, and it has served in effect to increase the amount of the award nearly seven or eight times. And then tacked on to that is $7.5 million for attorney's fees. So what was a $12.5 million refund to these some 4,000 or so fishermen has ballooned to $82 million. And the state has said that it is going to fight this and has intentions of filing an appeal, saying that that's an inappropriate way to calculate the accrual of interest. And they're saying that the refunds were not taxes, and it is a tax statute for delinquencies and tax refunds that's being used to allow for that high interest rate. So we'll see. So, I mean, it's like these guys have been delayed for 25 years, and there's another delay while the state hashes out the latest ruling.
Now, how many times has this case been tried? Just once?
Oh, wow. You're going to test my knowledge base here. There are four.
I mean, it's more than once.
Oh, yeah. It's been back and forth, and it's been to various levels of courts. They know that they have attempted to get it to the U.S. Supreme Court. That has not been effective. But there are four different versions of this case over the years that have come forward, all with different findings. So it's been a long and protracted fight. In the end, these guys, the fishermen, are prevailing. But, you know, there's huge variances in terms of how much fishermen will take away from this. Some of them, if the interest rates stay, we'll get more than $200,000. Some of them are only getting, you know, like $1.60, I think, was the lowest award amount. So it's pretty wide range.
One more question. Couldn't they bifurcate the case in the sense that they could appeal the interest rate and pay, the state would pay the recipients the what they're just due without the interest?
I believe in theory they can do that. I think it requires a legislative appropriation in order to actually make these refunds, and I don't believe that that has occurred at this time. So I don't know, even if they were to bifurcate it, what the realistic outcomes would be.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the legislature takes up legislation that for a number of cases, there are any number of them, mm-hmm. in which court cases, judgments against the state have to be paid. Jill, also, you had an exciting time on the Iditarod and did it all and flew a lot, saw a lot, and just from talking to you off camera, it was a pretty wonderful experience, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great. You know, I have only had the privilege prior to now of covering some of the checkpoints that are accessible from Anchorage as day trips, Squintna and Yetna. And those are a lot of fun. You know, they're kind of like these big tailgate parties that happen on these frozen rivers as the mushers come through. But you really don't get the full flavor of this race that you read about and you see on TV and you might read in the newspaper. And, you know, it's legendary. But being able to travel alongside it as it's happening and watch it unfold as they're coming through these communities and these checkpoints is a completely different perspective on what happens out there. And mushers are tough, hardy folks. Those dogs are amazing. The volunteers that participate to help make the race happen is really incredible. And then you just see this incredible landscape as you move through the interior to the northern coast, northwestern coast, and it's just stunning.
And in Nome, they had quite the party, and they note every time a musher shows up, right?
They do, yeah. There's this siren that goes off every time the mushers are heading down Front Street. So, you know, of course, when Lance Mackey came in, it went off, and that was a huge kind of processional victory run down Front Street to the Broiled Arch. But after that, for every subsequent musher, that siren goes off. And any hour of day, at any time of day, it's, you know, that
sirens in your dreams.
Yeah, and everybody knows if you're listening for somebody or you want to go see it, you hear that noise, you throw your clothes on and you run out to the Broiled Arch. So
then see who it is.
And see who it is, right? Or if you're monitoring, you probably have a good sense.
Yeah, well,
of
that's
who's
right. That's
through,
right. But. Okay. Let's move on. Governor Sean Parnell visits Florida, hears the woes of the cruise industry, returns to Alaska, and is ready to reduce the head tax on passengers. Paul, what's the governor's argument for a reduction and how would it be structured?
Well, one of the arguments is we've got 143,000 fewer visitors coming to Alaska on cruise ships this year, supposedly. That's cost Alaskans jobs and Alaskans money. We charge them now $46 a head. The cruise industry said that's too much, it's onerous, and Parnell, and they've sued because part of that, 25% of it, is used to be for infrastructure away from the coast. It's infrastructure in Anchorage or infrastructure in Fairbanks. They said it's unconstitutional. You can't tax us for this and then do something with it up there. So he's proposing to drop that fee by 25%, and also in doing so, allow them Juneau and Ketchikan taxes that they're assessed there. So it actually could knock it down to $19 a head. And the reason being, it's got a lot of opposition, but the tourism industry up here is taking quite a beating over this. And I think one of the things they want to do is they want to get that down so we can attract cruise ship industry. The governor pretty much told them, hey, I want to see some results. If we roll this tax, you better bring your boats back. And beyond that, we'll have to wait and see if it does any good.
Steve, the legislature not only has a limited amount of time before legislators go home, mm-hmm. but this is a citizen initiative that was passed a few years ago. And what's the legislature likely to do?
Well, there's been a lot of citizen-passed legislation that the legislature has decided to change after a couple of years. That's happened on quite a few occasions. It's happened. I don't know why they would do that, but not following the will of the people. Imagine politicians doing that. I don't know about this one. This passed by a fairly healthy margin a few years back. There is an active group, Responsible Cruising in Alaska. Chip Toma is the president of that organization. That's the group that put this on the ballot and got it passed. There are some folks who said, they really didn't spell out all of the ramifications of that initiative, but people supported it and felt that it was time for the cruise ship industry to pay its fair share. That organization's still around. It could play a very active role in what happens in November when elections roll around. And that's something that I think that legislators are probably going to be very wary of.
Well, I'm kind of wondering of the politics, too, and that is Governor Parnell goes to Florida, meets with these people, mm-hmm. comes back and says, you're right, I got to change the law. Yeah. It sort of looks like that his opponents would have an opportunity to use that old phrase, caving in.
Right, or pandering to the cruise ship industry. Yeah, but and Governor Parnell, what he's trying to do, and Paul mentioned it, he's trying to get assurances from the cruise ship industry that you'll bring ships back, you'll hire Alaskans. and I think the cruise ship industry is taking the stance, well, we'll see what the legislature does. And if the legislature approves this, it depends. If he gets no assurances, it may be tough to pass this thing.
And you're describing is a real dance. That's what
you got. Yeah, it really is right now. It truly is. And then you'll talk to people who are against what the governor's trying to do, and they'll just say, it's not the head tax. It's the economy. We're in a recession right now, a global recession, and that's what's keeping people at home. They're just choosing not to get on cruise ships right now because the economy is so shaky.
Paul, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I'd like to go on a cruise ship.
You can go on a cruise ship.
Thank you very much.
Okay, go ahead.
Just for whatever it's worth, Alaska's tax is the highest in the world. And I think that really does make a cruise line take a look at this and look at it very hard. When you add that to, and there's all kinds of regulations in this law that nobody's even talking about, but the environmental protection regulations are also very expensive.
Steve.
One thing to add, too, is that generally when voters get together, when citizens get together and they pass an initiative, it's usually out of frustration. The legislature had this issue before. This has been debated in the state legislature, and the legislature did nothing about it. Finally, some citizens got angry enough to take this into their own hands. And at that particular point, you certainly do have debate, but you wonder what the legislature maybe had a chance to craft a much better, more equitable bill for all had it acted.
So, yeah, there's another thing I know from personal experience, and that is the way the lobbyists who are against changing the law will operate on an initiative is they'll come into the individual legislator's office, mm-hmm. and bring up a piece of paper and says, this is how many people voted for this bill, this is how many voted against it. Did you know that 58% of your constituents agree with me and not with the governor, mm-hmm. or whatever?
Yeah, so, right.
The other side will do the other, too.
Right.
So, especially right before an election, I think it's some pretty tough sledding. Yeah.
I'm not saying that a voter initiative or the legislature crafting a bill is going to be flawless. We certainly have seen plenty of bad legislation passed or legislation that needs to be tweaked later on. But it's just, you know, generally, my observation is when it's a citizen-backed initiative, it tends to be to one extreme a little bit. You know,
when it comes out of frustration with
does,
the legislature.
It does, and you can understand that. You can understand why.
Jill, read all about it. Galena on the Iditarod on the Yukon River may get nuclear energy.
Yeah, that's a big may. It's something that they've been looking at. They've been looking at it for several years. They have, like so many other rural communities, major energy problems in the sense of cost effectiveness. They are the site of a former military installation that built a power plant large enough to support that installation as well as the local community. That base has since pulled out. The community is working to try to figure out how to make that campus continue on. They've done that through some educational systems. But you have this power plant that really far exceeds the needs of the local village, and they're having now to bear the burden of the increased costs of keeping that running without the United States Air Force there as the primary consumer and payer of that tab. It's a big burden. You know, the grocery store told me that their utility bills each month can top $6,000. And, you know, her quote to me was, one month I had a $5,000 bill and I did a happy dance. And most people probably would think I'm crazy, but it was $1,000 savings. And so they're talking about a significant amount of money. This nuclear reactor, as it's proposed, is a Toshiba model that is not under authorization for use here in the United States. There's no regulatory permission for the model itself, nor for use in Alaska. So it's experimental. It's a long way down the road before seeing it happen. And I'm not sure that the community is as receptive to it as it once was in 2004 when it was first proposed. And there are neighboring communities that don't trust the technology and fear that it could have some negative consequences environmentally. So it's just one of many options that they're looking at. And we'll see. We're told that Toshiba, or the National, the Nuclear Regulatory Agency of the United States, says that Toshiba has intentions of filing a letter of intent to move forward with the project, and that would be the first step before this moves any further.
Okay, good enough. The FBI paid informant Frank Pruitt $200,000 for his cooperation during the corruption probe. Steve, who is Pruitt? And for those who don't remember, what do we believe he told the government?
Well, Frank Pruitt was the former Commissioner of Corrections for the state of Alaska under Governor Wally Hickel's second term in office back in the early to mid-90s. In the, actually Jill was always our expert at Channel 2 for this, but when the FBI probe started a few years back, Pruitt became an informant where he taped conversations with people who were under investigation.
Vic Coring, Tom Anderson.
Vic Coring, Tom Anderson, to name a few, yeah. Coring and Anderson were both convicted. A lot of it was based on what Pruitt provided the FBI and the prosecution. And there was some court papers that were filed recently that spelled out that the FBI paid Pruitt for his work. And the FBI won't confirm this. They won't confirm the amount. But they do say that they do this as sort of a reward for somebody cooperating and helping in an investigation like this. It was pretty labor intensive.
Okay, you mentioned that Jill sat in the trials, and I was going to ask her before we go to Paul, anything, what can you tell us about watching Frank Pruitt in court?
Well, I think, you know, over the course of time in some of the early trial, it came out that he thought that he might have been under investigation by the FBI for some criminal misdeeds himself or possible exposure. At one time he was asked about that by a defense attorney, and I believe Pruitt's response at the time was that he felt that he had been investigated and cleared, that he hadn't been promised he'd been cleared, but it was his understanding the matters for which might be problematic for him were beyond the statute of limitations, including a sizable loan from somebody while he was still the commissioner, in addition to a possible campaign donation problem. So, I don't know that his involvement is as altruistic as we have since heard from him that it is. And
he repeatedly testified at the trial, I'm here to help my country.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm here to do the right thing, to root out corruption, to help my country, and do this as a service and a duty. And I'm not sure that was the initial shoehorn that got him involved to begin with. It may have ended up that way. And certainly he did put in a lot of hours and a lot of work, and the FBI or prosecutors had said on the stand that they owe a great debt to Mr. Pruitt for everything that they provided to him. He was also at one point, I think the Lisa Deamer's article in the Daily News points out that he was at one point asked on the stand, are you getting compensated for this, or didn't you ask for compensation? And he admitted that, yeah, after a year, year and a half in, that he sought some compensation for the hours, but there was no confirmation that he had actually been paid or what that amount might be.
Maybe that depended on the timing of it, too. Paul, we're about to run out of time. You have anything you want to add here in 15, 20 seconds?
I think there's a lot of mixed emotions about it. I don't think people really like the idea of the government paying people off, but there's a need for it in this kind of case.
On the other hand, they've paid murderers,
yeah, they pay
arson,
murderers, tax dodge,
a whole lot of other people.
They do.
Okay, we're about out of time here for Anchorage Edition. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.